Well, turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 17 as we continue to look at 2 Samuel. And this evening I want to read from verse 24 of chapter 17 over to 18, verse 18. And this is an account of the defeat and the death of Absalom. Of course, the son of David who rebelled against him. Chapter 17, verse 24. Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. Absalom set Amasa over the army in place of Joab. Now Amasa was the son of a man whose name was Ithra the Israelite, who went into Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister of Zariah, Joab's mother. And Israel and Absalom camped in the land of Gilead. Now when David had come to Mahanaim, Shobi the son of Nahash from Reba of the sons of Ammon, Machir the son of Amiel from Lodabar, and Barzillai the Gilead from the Gileadite from Rogalim, brought beds, basins, pottery, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans, lentils, parched seeds, honey, curds, sheep, and cheese of the herd for David and for the people who were with him to eat. For they said, "The people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness." Then David numbered the people who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. David sent the people out, one third under the command of Joab, one third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zariah, Joab's brother, and one third under the command of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the people, "I myself will surely go out with you also." But the people said, "You should not go out, for if we indeed flee, they will not care about us. Even if half of us die, they will not care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, now it is better that you be ready to help us from the city." Then the king said to them, "Whatever seems best to you, I will do." So the king stood beside the gate, and all the people went out by hundreds and thousands. The king charged Joab and Abishai and Ittai, saying, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." And all the people heard when the king charged all the commanders concerning Absalom. Then the people went out into the field against Israel, and the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. The people of Israel were defeated there before the servants of David, and the slaughter that day was great, 20,000 men. For the battle there was spread over the whole countryside, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword devoured. Now Absalom happened to meet the servants of David, for Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head caught fast in the oak, so he was left hanging between heaven and earth, while the mule that was under him kept going. When a certain man saw it, he told Joab and said, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak." Then Joab said to the man who had told him, "Now behold, you saw him. Why then did you not strike him there to the ground? And I would have given you 10 pieces of silver and a belt." The man said to Joab, "Even if I should receive 1,000 pieces of silver in my hand, I would not put out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king charged you and Abishai and Ittai, saying, 'Protect for me the young man Absalom.' Otherwise, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there's nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof." Then Joab said, "I will not waste time here with you." So he took 3 spears in his hand and thrust them through the heart of Absalom while he was yet alive in the midst of the oak. And 10 young men who carried Joab's armor gathered around and struck Absalom and killed him. Then Joab blew the trumpet, and the people returned from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained the people. They took Absalom and cast him into a deep pit in the forest and erected over him a very great heap of stones. And all Israel fled, each to his tent. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself a pillar, which is in the king's valley. For he said, "I have no son to preserve my name." So he named the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day. Well, I guess there are many lessons that come out of the account of Absalom, but certainly one of the main lessons in the account of Absalom which is repeated throughout the Bible, Old and New Testaments, and that is that to set yourself against God, against His people, against His chosen, is really a form of suicide, if you will. It's a form of that it will always end in complete shame and death. Remember that God said of Israel that they were the apple of His eye, and anyone who touches them touches the apple of My eye. And I think we could say that that's true of all of His children. That's true of you. If you belong to Him and you are in Christ, you are the apple of His eye. It's true of the Jewish people because He said it of them. And it was certainly true of David. And even though God was punishing David for his sin, He was chastising His child for his sin, yet He was also protecting David. David was His child. When you raise up yourself against God's chosen, you are more or less committing suicide. And you will be shown a complete and utter fool, because God is sovereign. And God always keeps His own. And He protects His own. As we come to this text, there are two things. I actually divide this whole text. I don't know if I'll get through this, because I know we have communion, but I'd kind of like to get through this whole text tonight. I divide it into two sections. On the one hand, you see God's blessing on David. And on the other hand, you see God's curse on Absalom. So like the first part, from chapter 17, verse 24 down to 18:5, you see God's blessing on David. And then from 18, verse 6 down to verse 18, you see the total curse on Absalom. And it's a picture, really, of God's providence and God's work. And I wanted to remind you that in a sense here, that not in a sense, David is truly outnumbered. I mean, Absalom has gathered all of Israel together, just as Hushai had suggested. So he is greatly outnumbered. But all along the way, you see God's hand is on David, even though he's under chastisement. God's hand is on David, and God's hand is utterly opposed to Absalom. You really couldn't make this up, his ending, right? I mean, it's pretty astounding. It reminds me of what Paul said in Romans 8. He said regarding believers, it's that God, if God be for us, who can be against us? And of course, the reverse is true too. If God be against you, who could possibly be before you? Listen, if you set yourself up against God, what do you have? I mean, you will be destroyed. I mean, it's folly. And that's Absalom's situation. Absalom, as we know, rebelled against his father. He came into Jerusalem. David fled. Ahithophel, the counselor that had left David and went with Absalom, Ahithophel suggested that he go immediately and go chase David and kill David before he crosses the Jordan River. And Hushai, who was actually helping David and pretended that he was with Absalom, right? He suggested that they wait and that they gather all of Israel together and go across the Jordan with all of Israel and find David and destroy all of them who are with David and turn it into a great battle and Absalom would go himself. Well, that's where we left this. Ahithophel, when he found out his counsel was not followed, I think basically out of pride, it was out of pride, he committed suicide. And now we see the outworking of Hushai's advice, and we see the end of Absalom. And this was what God used. Remember, we go back to chapter 17, verse 14, where it says, "Then Absalom and all the men of Israel said, 'The counsel of Hushai the Archite is better than the counsel of Ahithophel, for the Lord had ordained to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel so that the Lord might bring calamity upon Absalom.'" And this chapter now, this section, really explains how it was that God used the counsel of Hushai to bring calamity on Absalom. This was all God's providential working. It really is amazing that God is over it all. He really is. He is sovereign. This is why there's only one thing you have to figure out. that the Lord is on your side. That's really all you have to figure out in any situation, really. It's not about what's best for me or what, you know, I think is going to work out. It's just make sure that you're walking with the Lord, right? Make sure that you're on his side, if I could put it that way. That's really the whole thing in life, really. But at any rate, that's getting ahead of myself. If we look here then at verses, chapter 17, verse 24, let's consider God's blessing on David. Chapter 17, verse 24, down to chapter 18, verse 5, really focuses more on David as they prepare for this battle. And if I can divide that section into three parts, I think we see, first of all, God's providential protection. We see God's abundant provision. And we see David's wise preparation, which is a part of God's blessing too. I mean, David isn't passive here. David's very active. And but I want you to observe, first of all, God's providential protection. As you read verse 24 through 26, it says, "Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him. Absalom met Amasa over the army in place of Joab. Now Amasa was the son of a man whose name was Ithra the Israelite, who went into Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, the sister of Zariah, Joab's mother. And Israel and Absalom camped in the land of Gilead." I'll just say a couple words about this. And when I speak about God's protection of David, I would see God's protection several ways here. First of all, well, actually, let me go back and point out verse 22, which was also part of God's protection. Remember, because of Hushai's counsel was followed, it says, "David and all the people who were with him arose and crossed the Jordan, and by dawn, not even one remained who had not crossed over the Jordan." So God, in this, again, allowed David to get across the Jordan River, and everybody, crossing a river is not necessarily an easy task. And everybody got across, and to think about it, they were doing it at night. I'm not sure how they did that, but God protected them. God protected David and all that were with him, and they got across the Jordan. So you see right here, again, God's protection. But then down here in verse 24, we find that he ends up in Mahanaim. Now, Mahanaim is, first of all, it was a walled city. I know that only because of later on in chapter 18, it talks about when they come back to David and they see the watchman and they see him from the wall. So they're in a walled city, which is a huge advantage, a big protection. David's in a walled city. So God allows David to cross the river, get over to this walled city, Mahanaim, where he's protected. And by the way, Mahanaim is famous as the place where Abraham saw a company of angels in Genesis chapter 32. I won't go there, but this city was associated with Jacob's return to the land after being in exile for all those years. He came back and he saw the host of the Lord at Mahanaim. It doesn't really say much. This is actually just before he wrestled with the angel of the Lord, but it's not there that he wrestled, I don't think. But he saw this company of angels at Mahanaim. And it was a statement of God's protection of Jacob. And I think it's also here, perhaps, meant to be a statement of God's protection of David in a symbolic way. I would say it also, this verse points to God's protection in allowing David time to gather his army, his people, and again, to get into the city. It says, "And Absalom crossed the Jordan, he and all the men of Israel with him." Now, we don't know how long this took, how long it was between the time that David crossed the river and Absalom gathered all of Israel together. It had to be days. It could have been weeks. I don't know how long it would have taken him to gather this large group, but he followed Hushai's advice, delaying getting as large of a group of people together to go after David as possible. I'm assuming it was a very large army. And it took some time, I would think, to gather that all together and get it down there across the river and go into Gilead. So this is days, if not weeks. I don't know how long it took. But this was, again, God's providential protection of David, allowing David time. And It seems that even through this, David, it would seem that David actually chose the battlefield, which we'll talk about in a minute. Verse 25 and verse 26 just speak of the fact that Amasa was Absalom's general and was also a nephew of David and a cousin of Joab. So they're all relatives. But at any rate, we find Israel and Absalom, verse 26, come over to the land of Gilead. Now, if you go to Israel, Gilead, for the most part, you just think of it east of the Jordan River. East of the Jordan River is Gilead. The first time I went to Israel, I was kind of fascinated by the fact it looks like a wall. As you look east and you see the Jordan Valley, Gilead is highland, and it goes up immediately. And this is where they were. This was the east of the Jordan. So we see his protection immediately here in allowing him into the city and to escape and having time to regather. We also see God's abundant provision in verses 27 through 29. So again, David is here. Now think about it. They left Jerusalem in a great hurry. They did not have much time to gather things. They were, they had to leave immediately. When David found out that Absalom was coming into the city, they left immediately. So they didn't pack, and so they didn't have a lot. But God providentially, when I say providentially, I don't mean it was miraculously. There wasn't manna from heaven came down. God used means to provide for them, and those means were three men. So it says in verse 27, "Now when David had come to Mahanaim, Shobi the son of Nahash from Reba of the sons of Ammon, Machir the son of Ammiel from Lodabar, and Barzillai the Gilead from Rogalim, brought beds, basins, pottery, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans, lentils, parched seeds, honey curds, sheep, and cheese of the herd for David and for the people who were with him to eat. For they said, 'The people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness.'" I'm sure that was an amazing sight for David and all these people who were hungry and tired to see all these provisions brought to them. Again, they didn't... armies are known for this, right? I mean, if you read about the Civil War here in America, one of the reasons the South was so devastated is as the North went through the South, they raided the farms, they raided all the all the plantations. They raided, they took whatever they needed for the army, right? And they sent people out to gather the wagons. And if you had chickens, whatever it was, you gathered it. Well, David didn't do that, but he relied on the Lord, and these men brought things to them. These three men are interesting, and maybe just observe who they are and the significance of it. The first significance is the first one that's mentioned, Shobi, the son of Nahash from Rabbah of the son of Ammon. Nahash was the king of the Ammonites. And the first significance in my mind of this is he's a Gentile. And it's amazing how much God used the Gentiles to really provide for David in this whole time, including much of his army was made up of all things, Philistines. But it's fascinating how God, all of Israel forsook David, but all these Gentiles are helping him. And one of them was Shobi. Now, Shobi was the son of Nahash. You remember, I think it was chapter 10. Somewhere back in there, that when David took the Ammonites, we remember when Nahash, his son, became king, David sent an emissary to several people, a couple men to him to, congratulate him and wish him well and bring a present and all that. And they sent them back ashamed, because they thought they were spies, or they treated them like spies. Well, this Shobi is that guy's brother. And we don't know whether or not he became king or what his situation was, but he had a relationship with David. And he brings supplies. He was probably a wealthy man. and brought supplies for David. When you look at Machir, the son of Amiel from Lodabar, the only thing we know about him anywhere else in Scripture that I'm aware of is he's the one that Mephibosheth was staying with when David found him. If you go back to chapter 9, you remember Mephibosheth, who was the son of Jonathan, who was lame on both feet. And when David was looking for someone that he could show kindness to from the house of Saul, particularly from Jonathan's, because of the covenant they had with Jonathan, he sent some messenger to find out where we, you know, who we could show kindness to. They found this guy. Verse 4, so the king said to him, "Where is he?" And Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he is in the house of Machir, the son of Amiel, in Lodabar." And this man witnessed the kindness of David to Mephibosheth. And so he comes and brings supplies for David. Barzillai, the Gileadite, we don't really know much about him. We see him later on in chapter 19 when David returns, but we don't really know a lot about him. He was Jewish. But at any rate, these three wealthy men, God providentially moved in their hearts to bring supplies to David and his men. It must have been a lot because David had, we don't know how many he had, but he had thousands because he had, and when he organizes the army, he has commanders over thousands. So he has several thousand people. That's a lot of people to feed. And so these men brought a lot. And it's quite a list there of things that they brought. And God supplied him. And we see here again in this passage the means of this provision, these three men. We see the abundance of this provision. And we also see the timeliness of this provision. They were hungry. And, you know, God's people are often in distress. We are often in the wilderness, so to speak. And I think most of us at some point or another in our lives find ourselves in places like that. And God provides what we need when we need it, and he provides abundantly. And we see this here. In fact, a lot of people associate Psalm 23, verse 5 with this, where you remember this psalm, the Lord is my shepherd, and he says he prepares for me a table in the presence of mine enemies. And here, the Lord provides for David in the presence of his enemies, an abundant supply that prepares them for the battle. And I say prepares them for the battle because I've never been a soldier, but you know, if you're hungry and weak because you haven't eaten much, it's kind of hard to fight. So this was God's provision for David before the battle. I want to point out too, this is maybe a side note, but this is the context of Psalm 3. And I do want to point this out because it shows us David's situation, but it also shows us how David in this time looked to the Lord. And it gives us and I just want to read Psalm 3 if you want to turn there. It actually, the title of Psalm 3 is a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom, his son. And I don't want to go into too much detail, but I just want to read through the psalm and point some things out. He says, "O Lord, how my adversaries have increased. Many are rising up against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no deliverance for him in God." And I think the reason they were saying that, is because of his sin. I think they were saying, you know, God isn't for David. And all of Israel rose up against him. Verses 1 and 2 are what are called a climactic chiasm. It's a climactic parallelism where each phrase builds on the other. So it's like this climax, like all of Israel is against him. And they're saying there is no deliverance for him in God. Then in verse 3 he says, "But you, O Lord, are a shield about me. My glory and the one who lifts up my head. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy mountain. And verse 4 is kind of the, again, a chiastic way. That's the center of the psalm. And this is what God's children do. God's children, in a time of need, call upon the Lord. And the Lord answers, right? I love verse 5. He says, I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustains me. And because he cried unto the Lord, because he trusted the Lord, he actually could sleep soundly in the midst of this situation, not knowing how it was going to end, not knowing how the Lord was going to deliver him, not knowing what the, you know, the completion of the story was, but trusting in the Lord, he could actually sleep. In verse 6, he says, I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me round about. And that was his situation. All of Israel, literally, had surrounded him. I mean, wanting to kill him. He says, I will not be afraid. Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you have smitten all mine enemies on the cheek. You have shattered the teeth of the wicked. And by the way, I think he said this before it happened. I think this was his faith. He knew the Lord was going to deliver him. Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing be upon your people. The Lord sustains his children in times of distress. Again, even in a time when he was under chastisement. I say to you, if you're a child of God and you're under chastisement, you know it. Listen, don't run from God. Run to God. Trust him. Call upon him. Seek him. Listen, if you belong to him, he will always hear you, right? And you humble yourself before him. He will provide for your needs. He will take care of you. And he will teach you. And he did teach David. Then in chapter 18, verses 1 through 5, we see God or David's wise preparation. And again, we emphasize the fact that even though we trust the Lord, and we do trust the Lord, right? Even though we trust the Lord, it doesn't mean we don't use means. And it doesn't mean that we're just passive in life and we just wait for God to deliver us. There are times in Scripture where the Jewish, you know, the Israelites were told to stand still and watch the deliverance of the Lord. But there were many times they were called to actually go out and fight the enemy. Right? And they were called to fight here, right? They were not called to just sit back and see if an earthquake would take out the people. They were to fight. And David is a very wise warrior, right? He orders his soldiers. Again, we don't know how many he has, but we see here his wise preparation for the battle in verses 1 through 5. It says, then David numbered the people who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. And then David sent the people out, one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, one-third under the command of Ittai the Gittite. And the king said to the people, I myself will surely go out with you also. So David here puts them all in order, divides them up, makes sure they're commanders at different levels, and then divides them into three groups with three commanders that he trusts, puts them over them. He's a man of order. I appreciate that, right? We ought to use our minds, we ought to use our brain, and we ought to be diligent. We also observe here that he agrees in verse 2 through 4 not to participate in the battle. This is an interesting, honestly, I don't want to say too much about this for sake of time, but it is kind of interesting. It says at the end of verse 2, the king said to the people, I myself will surely go out with you also. And understand, David's a pretty old man here. David has obviously been in many battles. He was a very great warrior, had an amazing reputation as a warrior from the time of, you know, Goliath, which was in his teens, to now he's, I'm guessing, 60, I don't know. He's up there in age. And he says, I will go out. It has been suggested that one of the reasons David wanted to go out was he wanted to make sure that his son would be protected. And I think that's very likely. I'll say a little bit more of that in a minute. But he says in verse 3, "But the people said, 'You should not go out, for it, if we indeed flee, they will not care about us. Even if half of us die, they will not care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, now it is better that you be ready to help us from the city.' Then the king said to them, 'Whatever seems good, best to you, I will do.'" That's interesting. It's interesting to me that the people refused to let him go. And it's interesting to me that David relinquished and said, "Yeah, okay, I'll listen to you." And that's not very typical. Like, I don't think you would have expected that in David's early days, right? There is a, I don't know what the right word for it is, but there's a kind of a softness in David that he did not have before his sin. And he relinquishes to, you know, apparently all of the people were very much opposed to him going to battle. And he agreed that he would not go into battle. But he did support them in the second half of verse 4. He says, "So the king stood beside the gate." Gate implies walls, so all city. He's in Mahanaim. So he has he's standing by the gate, and he's watching all the soldiers go by, the army goes by, all the people went out by hundreds and thousands. That's a pretty large parade of people going by. He's there to encourage them and to show that he's supporting them as their king. And then in verse 5, he gives this charge. He says, the king charged Joab and Abishai and Ittai. Now, those are the three commanders, saying, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." And all the people heard when the king charged all the commanders concerning Absalom. Now, it seems to me that David's fatherly concern for his rebellious, yea, wicked son was, at this point, not wise. And I say that, first of all, because, I mean, here you're, you know, Joab killed Absalom, which we're going to see in here in a minute, even though David said this. And I can't help it. I mean, you feel for Joab because you agree with Joab that Absalom had to be killed for the good of the kingdom, for the good of the people. And you see David's fatherly love for his son getting in the way of what was wise for the people. He was a rebel. And, I mean, he was wicked. He slept with his wives. He slept with David's wives. He was he was trying to overthrow and kill David. And yet, I think part of the reason David wanted to go easy on Absalom is because he realized that this all was because of his own sin. And we'll say more about that later on when David receives the news of Absalom's death, and he can hardly, I mean, he's just weeping, right? He can't contain himself. And I think it's because he realizes he should have died for his sin. And instead, all of this took place because of his sin. And he wished, and he actually says later on, you know, "Oh, that I had died instead of Absalom." And I think he felt that this was all his responsibility. And so he wanted to deal gently with Absalom, but it wasn't a very realistic command to capture Absalom without doing him harm, I don't think. But at any rate, this is what he puts on the commanders: deal gently with Absalom. Now, well, being that it's a quarter of, I think we'll look at the second half next time. So, there is actually a lot here in the second part here about Absalom, God's curse on Absalom, which goes from verse 6 through 18. And so we'll stop there and we'll look at God's curse on Absalom next week. But it is, again, what we've seen here already in this first part, is God's amazing goodness to his children when they look to him. And quite frankly, even sometimes when we don't look to him, God is so faithful, and he's so gracious to his people. And we're thankful for the testimony of that in the scriptures. I say this about biblical history. I say this about church history. The more you understand history, especially the history of God's people, the more you realize this has nothing to do with the greatness of people. I don't care who you look at in church history or in the history of the Bible. It's true, there were some great men. There were some truly godly men. We think of people like Daniel or Joseph who were exceptional, truly. But the vast majority of even great men had so many flaws. And as you read church history, you're just scratching your head like, man, God, you are so patient. You are so patient with your people. And God, in spite of us, works out his plan. And he did it with David. And listen, we look to him. We trust in him. We don't trust ourselves. We trust him because he is good. And he is faithful to those whom he calls unto himself. And as we'll see next week, there's no fighting against God. A common theme in the Bible. To reject God is to reject life. Or as Solomon said, to sin against him is to embrace death. It's to love death. And that's what Absalom did. He embraced death and shame. So we'll look at that next week.